rip-off edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, CWB giveaway. History of humans, economic revolutions, the secret of happiness at work, and Gervais and the Bible. Let's begin episode 296.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's wine is about the massive robbery by the Harper government of property belonging to Canadian farmers. It was recently announced that the majority shares of the Canadian Wheat Board would be sold to G3 Global Grain Group. G3 is a joint venture between American megacorp Bung Canada and Celia Canada, a subsidiary of the Saudi Agriculture and Livestock Investment Company, which is itself part of the Saudi Sovereign Fund. For those who may not be aware, the Canadian Wheat Board was established after the Great Depression as a way to help stabilize agricultural production, and it also helped ensure Canadian farmers a fair return on their grain. The board operated as a quasi-cooperative, with 10 of its 15 board of directors elected by farmers, with the remainder appointed by the government. It was given a monopoly over the sale of wheat and barley on the prairies. Well, technically it was a monopsony. That is, it only had a monopoly on who could sell, not on who could produce or buy grain. The system was set up to provide an upfront partial payment to farmers based on the expected return on the sale, then another payment at the end of the season amounting to the actual selling price of said grain. It provided stability for farmers because, in the event of catastrophic grain prices, even if the final selling price was less than the initial payment, the farmer got to keep all this payment, because the WCB set up and maintains a contingency fund to sort of take out the slack, with of course the government acting as a final safeguard if that contingency itself fell short. Now, before some of the more purists out there start caterwauling about government handouts, it's important to note that every developed nation subsidized its agricultural sector, and subsidized by billions of dollars. Think of Europe and the United States. It is often defended as part of a strategic consideration, natural defense kind of thing. A nation who is dependent on another for its food can also be held hostage by those nations. So in 2011, Harper passed what is known as the Marketing Freedom for Grain Farmers Act. This act stripped the board of its monopoly. Okay, sorry, some of you probably noticed, although technically incorrect, I think monopoly sounds better than the more confusing monopsony, so I'm going to put style over accuracy. So it removed its monopoly. While removing the monopoly, it also removed the farmers by abolishing their 10 seats on the board, with the remaining 5 appointed members given the task, mandated by the Act, of laying the groundwork for the eventual privatization of the CWB. Now this is where Bung, the multi-billion dollar American trading company, and Saliac, a subsidiary of the Saudi Sovereign Fund, come in. Note, a sovereign fund is a fund a government uses to invest in projects that forward the national interests of said nation. Something Harper seems unable to understand. Instead of investing in this nation, he sees his primary role as selling it out. Well, reports stated that they're actually only getting 50.1%, and that a farmer's trust will be getting the other 49.9%. Farmers will get a $5 unit in the trust for every ton of grain sold to the board. They'll even get a seat on the board. Well, not too bad, and it does sound like the farmers will get a piece of the national jewel that was the CWB. That is until you read a little more. The trust will give out these units until it reaches the $250 million mark, or 7 years, whichever comes first. At that point, the trust can be bought out by the other two partners. So one must ask, how much did the government sell the board for? Based on the numbers from the trust, it seems about $500 million. One must ask, why so cheap? The 2011 financial report of the board gave its revenues at over $7 billion. Okay, so you might say, without the monopoly, the board can't expect to make that kind of revenue. Well, irrespective of the grain, the board also controls a robust collection and distribution network for transporting grain to market. Again, in 2011, those properties were estimated to have a value of $3.4 billion. Let me repeat that last part. $3.4 billion dollars. And the Harper government stole it from the Canadian farmers and gave it to foreign business interests. How many times does $250 million go into $3.4 billion? And remind me again, why do people think the cons are financial wizards? It's historically well documented that the CWB was very effective at selling grain. It worked. For example, the pool in 2011 got a 15% increase on grain prices over what was expected, or about $1 billion. That money, of course, was paid to the farmers. That's how co-ops work. And now, thanks to Harper, that money would be siphoned off to foreign lands, FEC Canada and our farmers. Now, you may have noticed that I've been referencing 2011 numbers. You might wonder, what are the numbers for last year? How has it fared without the monopoly? Well, I can't tell you because the government has, since its hostile takeover in 2012, treated the financial records of the boards as a national secret. And what makes this criminal, why Harper should be tried is for treason, is that this cannot be undone. Even if Canadians voted in a rational government that actually operated in the interest of the nation and its people, the NDP for example, our free trade agreements stipulate that not only would we have to buy out the foreigners at fair market value, which would seem to be in the billions, but we would also be on the hook for their future profits, also in the billions. And that's a claim that we can't legally challenge. It's built into these free trade agreements and why they can be so dangerous to national sovereignty. You know, I took a look at our latest polling numbers and wonder, what the hell are farmers thinking? Pre the Alberta orange crush, the cons were polling 40 to 45% in the prairies. They are supporting, one might say blindly, the very party that is ripping them off, treating them like dirt, if you will. One cannot help but draw comparisons to the prairies and the Republican support in the southern states, states that have suffered the worst from GOP policies. But of course, I did say might. And post-Alberta crush, maybe we're seeing a turning point. Maybe you can only kick an old farm dog so many times before it turns around and bites you in the ass. And we can make this happen. We need to spread the word. Take the story about how the Harper government gave away $3 billion to a foreign corporation, robbed Canadian farmers of $7 billion in profits, how they have cheated and destroyed a crown jewel of Canada, and make sure everyone you know, every conservative you know, understands the con that's going on. We need to make people realize what is going on in this country. It's just not about the dissolution of the Canadian Wheat Board, but the continued denigration of Canadian society by Harper. This is only one instance of Harper and his Conservative Party abusing power, cheating Canada, denigrating Canada, making it a much worse place to be in. We need to ensure that they are not re-elected. Deny them another term to continue the destruction of this country. 2015 may be the last chance we have to save this country. It's time we make Harper and the Conservative parties a historical footnote. The vote for our interests. Vote for our nation. Vote for Canada. 2015, never forget. We'll return after this break.
Oh, Does Your Majesty really agree that your Governor General, the Queen's own Viceroy in Canada, should be overruled by the elected members?
Yes, Lord Melbourne. We assure you we do agree.
You mean to say that Victoria of Great Britain would give up her royal power to some obscure politician from Montreal or Toronto?
Lord Melbourne, Monsieur Lafontaine and Mr. Baldwin are trying to bring harmony to the colony with this... What do they call it, Lord Melbourne?
Responsible government, ma'am.
Responsible government, just so. Now, suppose we do not assent, Prime Minister.
Well, that could mean another rebellion in the Canadas.
Responsible government. Our Governor General controlled by an elected assembly instead of by us. It's a Canadian idea.
Pity, ma'am.
Very well, Lord Melbourne. We think we know what we must do.
Today in the news.
And today in the news.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
And we're back. Now, I'm a big fan of progress. I think humanity has, over time, made the world a better and better place for himself and for, well, most, okay, for himself at least. But there's an interesting thing about our constant drive, how we seem to be never satisfied in the moment with what we have. Every new advancement seems to spur us to something more because once we have it, it doesn't seem quite good enough. It only raises our expectations. And this just isn't me. We're going to play a little web wisdom of someone who's done sort of the complete history of humanity, who deals with this particular topic. Let's listen in.
I'm going to introduce you to Yuval Noah Harari, the author of Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. I'm going to abandon journalistic detachment for just a moment to say that this is the most stimulating work of nonfiction I have read in years. Sapiens was published in Hebrew in 2011. It's been translated into 26 languages, and now it's out in English. It's a bestseller in Europe, Africa, and Asia. Harari is a historian at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, but he doesn't fit into the usual academic boxes. The very idea of writing a history of the species is itself an audacious and even grandiose notion, especially when the author is still in his 30s. The genius of this book is in the questions it asks.
Two very important things is that this book tries to give the entire picture of history from the very beginning up until the 21st century and actually going even into the future, trying to see what are the possibilities ahead of us. And in doing so, the book combines insights from biology with insights from history and from the humanities. My basic understanding is that you can't really do history without biology, but biology isn't enough. It's just the basis. And so you have to combine the two. And secondly, it was very important for me to try and understand not only what happened in history, but also its deeper meaning, especially in terms of the lives of individuals. So throughout the book, one of the main questions was not only what happened, but did it make people more miserable, happier? How did it influence the daily life of the average individual?
Which is something that comes through enormously in the book. People have written about evolution, progress, the basics of human history for a long time, but you seem to ask questions like, was the agricultural revolution good or bad for us as a species? Is progress good? You ask these questions in a way that is strikingly new.
Yes, I think what is really new is the attempt to ask questions about happiness and suffering. Usually when we describe history, we focus on questions of power, how our species gained power, how particular kingdoms and empires and collectives gained power, and how particular individuals like Genghis Khan or Hitler gained power. So most of history, in most history books, revolves around questions of power. And power is, of course, very important, but there is another side to the story, and this is the side of happiness and suffering. And for me, the basic question is, how does power get translated into happiness or suffering? Humankind has an amazing ability to acquire power, but we seem to be much less capable when it comes to translating power into happiness. And again, you see throughout history this phenomenon that humankind is becoming far more powerful than before, but people are not becoming happier, and the world is not becoming a better place. And this, for me, was maybe the most interesting and most important thing about history, is to understand this relation, this complex relation between power and happiness.
Why is it this vicious cycle of progress versus happiness?
Well, there are three main mechanisms that scholars have identified. First of all, happiness does not really depend on objective conditions. Happiness depends far more on expectations. We are happy not when things are good, but when our expectations are fulfilled. And the problem with progress is that when conditions improve, expectations also increase. There is, for instance, the example of the Arab Spring and the revolution in Egypt in 2011.
Mubarak resigns. Tahrir Square responds.
About an hour after the news is announced across the square, that wall of sound is still there, barely diminished.
If you think in objective terms about the living conditions of the average Egyptian, things were never so good as under Hosni Mubarak. Nevertheless, as we all know, Egyptians were not terribly happy with the Mubarak regime. They made a revolution and toppled him, and now they are probably disappointed with the results of that as well. A second mechanism is on the biological level. What really determines human happiness or misery is not events in the outside world, but it is the condition of our biochemical system within our body. We still have basically the same biochemistry as in the Middle Ages or in the ancient world. And because what determines our happiness or misery is the biochemistry, not the economy, not politics, so things haven't really changed despite all the enormous historical and technological progress of humankind. And the third major explanation, perhaps the deepest explanation, is that the most basic reaction of the human mind to pleasure and to achievement is not satisfaction, but rather it is craving for more. Even when people experience something very pleasant, even when they have some big achievement, the reaction is not to be satisfied, but to be afraid that they will lose what they have, or to crave to have even more.
Let me tell you something. There is no nobility in poverty. I have been a rich man, and I have been a poor man, and I choose rich every time. Because at least as a rich man, when I have to face my problems, I show up in the back of a limo wearing a $2,000 suit and a $40,000 gold f***ing watch.
And because this is the most basic pattern of the human mind, no matter what humans have achieved throughout history, they are never satisfied, they simply crave for more. And this is what has been pushing history forward in the economic, in the technological field, in the political field. This is why we have acquired so much power, but we haven't become more satisfied than we were thousands of years ago.
Harari readily admits that trying to answer questions about how happy or content humans were in the distant past is speculative. But he says there are some good clues and scientific foundations. A good example of that comes from the agricultural revolution that occurred about 12,000 years ago.
When it comes to the agricultural revolution, we have quite a lot of evidence which is relevant to these issues of happiness and suffering. For instance, we know, and this we know from a lot of archaeological and anthropological evidence, that people suffered far more from disease after the agricultural revolution than before, because most infectious diseases that plague humankind actually come from domesticated animals, like cattle and sheep and pigs, even today.
More than 700 people have now died of swine flu across India since January. Most of them...
The bird flu has struck a second egg farm in Iowa. About 5.3 million laying hens will be destroyed after tests confirmed the outbreak. The
USDA... Almost every year, we hear about an epidemic of avian flu coming from domesticated chickens, or an epidemic of swine flu coming from domesticated pigs. Prior to the agricultural revolution, hunter-gatherers subsisted by eating dozens of different species of animals and plants and mushrooms and berries and nuts and so forth. So they got a very rich and balanced diet with all the nutrients and minerals and vitamins they needed. In contrast, most peasants, for much of history, subsisted on a single staple crop, like wheat in the Middle East, or potatoes in South America, or rice in East Asia. Their diet was much poorer, far less balanced, with far fewer minerals and vitamins and so forth, so they had a worse diet. And in addition to all these problems, they suffered far more from social hierarchies and social exploitation. In small hunter-gatherer tribes, there was very little room for social hierarchies and exploitation. But once you have the agricultural revolution, you witness the rise of cities and kingdoms and empires, and very big gaps between a very small elite that monopolizes most of the wealth and the vast majority of the population. If we adopt the viewpoint of a Chinese peasant in the Middle Ages, or even of working-class people today in the world, suddenly the agricultural revolution seems like a far worse idea. There are hundreds of millions of people today in the world that live much harder lives than their ancestors tens of thousands of years ago.
A very interesting take. We'll be back after this break.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
And we're back. We're going to kind of return to the theme of the weekly wine about revolution and how, even if you don't win one, it's important to keep trying. Like with the progress, each revolution pushes the bar up a bit, makes it a bit better, makes it a bit easier to overthrow those institutions, those central powers that control us all every day. So let's listen in to Economic Revolutions.
Revolutions in history have overthrown systems that people couldn't stand anymore. Slavery was overthrown. Here in the United States, we had a civil war, which was the form of the revolution which overthrew slavery, made slavery illegal as it is now written in that amendment of our Constitution. Feudalism, the system that existed for 1,000 years or more in Europe with lords and serfs, that was overthrown by a revolution, one we celebrate called the French Revolution of 1789. And finally, capitalism faced a revolution in 1917 in Russia, in 1949 in China, and so on. A revolution in which people calling themselves socialists said, we can't stand capitalism anymore, and we're building another system. In the case of slavery, feudalism, and capitalism, passions were raised. These revolutions were thought to usher in by their leaders and by their followers, a realm of freedom, of democracy, of human liberation. And in the name of those things, those revolutions were carried out. People rallied to that cause, hoping for that liberation and freedom. But it didn't come. Sure, did people get a better life? Absolutely. Slaves were freed. Serfs were freed. And in the revolutions against capitalism, people's education and medical care and housing were provided as a matter of right, something which still doesn't exist where private capitalism is dominant. So advances were made, make no mistake. But the promises, the hopes of human liberation and freedom were not realized. And that has made large numbers of people skeptical about the very idea of revolution. Made people imagine that human liberation was an unachievable goal, something you dream about, but do not mistake for a achievable reality. And I would like to talk to you about that in our remaining time. What happened in the revolutions against slavery, feudalism, and capitalism? Let's take a look. When the slaves were freed, the relationship master and slave was destroyed. In the United States Civil War, it was made illegal. Abraham Lincoln liberated the slaves. And there will be no more slavery in the United States, etc., etc. This was spectacular. This was a real freedom. This was an advance in human history. Slavery has been basically outlawed, with some notable exceptions, ever since. But was the slave liberated? Here's the irony. Yes, but also no. Weren't a slave anymore. Yes, but no, you weren't liberated, because in many cases, for example, here in the United States, the slave, no longer a slave, now free, looked around and discovered that he or she, in order to live, had to become somebody's employee, had to get a job. And in the relationship of employee to employer, these folks, these ex-slaves, discovered that human liberation and freedom were not available. They had to do what in their new position as an employee? They had to come to work 5 days a week. They had to pour their brains and muscles into a job. And the employer paid them less than the value of what those workers produced, because the difference between what the employer paid the worker and what the worker produced, we call that value added by the worker through his or her labor, what the worker produced was worth more than what the employer paid the worker, which is how the capitalist system works. The employer is in it for the profit, which honest employers will tell you. They know they're getting more from those workers than they pay for, because that's where the profit comes from. So the slaves discovered that they were now in a capitalist system, and that while that was an advance, it wasn't the liberation that they had imagined. Same thing for the feudal serf, tied to the land, subject to the landlord. From 500 AD to at least 1600, 1700 in Europe, feudalism is the dominant system. And eventually, the serfs rise up. They can't stand it. Took them 1,000 years in Europe. And in 1789, in the French Revolution, what were the slogans? Liberty, equality, fraternity. Liberté, égalité, fraternité in French. That's what those peasants wanted. Not just better food and shelter, that for sure, but also liberty, equality, and brotherhood. Well, they got the revolution. They overthrew feudalism. No more serfs tied to the land. People were free. No more landlord dictating what happened all the time. But they also got capitalism. And they discovered, the ex-serfs, that they were now employees and subject to the same lack of liberation that they had hoped for that I spoke earlier about in terms of the slaves. They were stuck in a capitalist system. Well, now let's finish the story. In 1917, the Soviet Union is born in a revolution against capitalism, the system of employers and employees, they thought. And they too spoke about freedom, equality, liberty, brotherhood, all of that, again, like the revolutions against slavery, like the revolutions against feudalism. And what did they achieve? An advance for the Russian people? Of course there was an advance. In 1917, Russia was one of the poorest, most backward countries in Europe. 50 years later, after this revolution had settled in, the Soviet Union was the world's second superpower after only the United States. They had become a modern, powerful, industrial country. Their revolution had achieved a lot. But did it achieve liberty, equality, fraternity, and all of that? Unquestionably not. So unquestionably not that in 1989, the Russian people had had enough of this and went back to private capitalism. Well, what had happened was in the Soviet Union, and this is similar to what happened in other parts of what we used to call the actually existing socialist world, you had gotten rid of the private employer, but you had substituted the government employer. Instead of a board of directors of your company elected by the shareholders, you had a board of directors, whatever the name, selected by the governing Communist Party or the government. You had a state official taking your product after you produced it, rather than a private person. For most people in actually existing socialist countries, they still went to work 9 to 5, 5 days a week, and produced more than they got in the way of wages and salaries. So they were in a state capitalist system rather than a private capitalist system. But free of capitalism, they hadn't become. Now, is the lesson here that you... is the lesson we want to learn that you can't have a revolution that achieves liberty, equality, and brotherhood? Not at all. The lesson here is that the great revolutions of the past against slavery, against feudalism, and against capitalism all made advances for the human community, but they all also missed something. And they all missed the same thing. And the important lesson for those thinking about revolution in the world today is to make sure they don't miss the lesson of the past, that revolution is possible, that revolution makes gains, but also that the gains made by the past revolutions missed something that can't afford to be missed again. What is it? In a nutshell, here it is. If you want to make a serious run at liberty, equality, and brotherhood, you have to organize the production process so that those values are in it. And that means you can't have some people producing more than they get back while other people get that extra without participating in producing it. The problem of slavery is that the slave produces a lot, the master gives the slave back relatively little, and keeps the rest for himself and to keep his system going. The problem with feudalism was that the serf produced more than he got to keep, and that extra was given to the lord for his lifestyle. And the problem of capitalism is that when you go to work, you produce more than you get in a wage or salary. And that extra is the profit of the businesses, which they use to maintain their lifestyle, build their power, control the government, and so on. If you want that to change, You've got to change the organization of production. And the way to do that is to democratize it, to say that all production will be organized so that the workers who together produce it, together decide what is done with the surplus or the profits they produce. Not some people get the profits while other people produce them. Not some people become wildly rich while everybody else is struggling to make ends meet. The minute you do that, you block the revolution from achieving the liberty, equality, and fraternity that was hoped for. This is not an impossible dream. Let me conclude by showing you why. In feudalism that lasted for 1,000 years in Europe, slowly, some manors, that's what they were called, where lords lived and serfs produced for them, some manors discovered over time small businesses arising. Serfs who ran away to a town would set up a little business. And they would arrange with other serfs who came later, hey, I have an idea, you work for me, I'll give you some money, and what you produce is mine. To make a long story short, inside of feudalism, little bits of capitalism began to grow. It was partly the breakdown of feudalism that enabled capitalist enterprises to get going, and eventually they got big, and eventually they contested and overthrew feudalism. In modern capitalism, worker co-ops, places where workers democratize the enterprise, they reject shareholders, they reject a board of directors of other people, they run the business themselves democratically. That's also developing all over the world, not just in Mondragon, Spain, not just in a collective of little businesses here or there. You know from this program, I talk about it a lot. Those worker co-ops are the beginnings of a mass change, just like the little capitalist enterprises that grew up in the middle of feudal Europe were the beginning of what eventually blew up in the French Revolution as the end of feudalism. Think about it. Change is happening. It's a question of recognizing it, understanding it, and developing where it can go. Revolution has been a dream of human beings for thousands of years, something that survives in the consciousness of desire of human beings is a very profound reality. Making it real is the agenda of the human race. Just like working out of slavery, working out of feudalism, and working out of capitalism has been.
Remember, people, you have nothing to lose but your chains. And maybe your iPod. But other than that, revolution is good. We're going to stop for another break. When we come back, we're going to end on sort of an up note. So, see you in a bit.
Snail Productions presents Inherent Vices with guests Ace Martins, Poor Baby, and Mary. Saturday, April 25th at the Railway Club. $10 cover, doors at 8:30.
And we're back. So next up is a humorous look at the secret to happiness and to better work. Let's listen in.
When I was 7 years old and my sister was just 5 years old, we were playing on top of a bunk bed. I was 2 years older than my sister at the time. I mean, I'm 2 years older than her now, but at the time that meant she had to do everything that I wanted to do, and I wanted to play war. So we were up on top of our bunk beds, and on one side of the bunk bed, I had put out all my G.I. Joe soldiers and weaponry, and on the other side were all my sister's Milos and ponies and ready for a cavalry charge. There are differing accounts of what actually happened that afternoon, but since my sister is not here with us today, let me tell you the true story. Which is my sister is a little bit on the clumsy side, and somehow, without any help or push from her older brother at all, suddenly Amy disappeared off of the top of the bunk bed and landed with this crash on the floor. And I nervously peered over the side of the bed to see what had befallen my fallen sister, and saw that she had landed painfully on her hands and knees on all fours on the ground. I was nervous because my parents had charged me with making sure that my sister and I played as safely and as quietly as possible. And seeing as how I had accidentally broken Amy's arm just 1 week before, heroically pushing her out of the way of an oncoming imaginary sniper bullet, for which I have yet to be thanked, I was trying as hard as I could. She didn't even see it coming. I was trying as hard as I could to be on my best behavior, and I saw my sister's face as wail of pain and suffering and surprise, threatening to erupt from her mouth and threatening to wake my parents from the long winter's nap for which they had settled. So I did the only thing my little frantic 7-year-old brain could think to do to avert this tragedy. If you have children, you've seen this hundreds of times before. I said, Amy, wait, don't cry, don't cry. Did you see how you landed? No human lands on all fours like that. Amy, I think this means you're a unicorn. Now that was cheating because there's nothing in the world my sister would want more than not to be Amy the hurt 5-year-old little sister, but Amy the special unicorn. Of course, this was an option that was open to her brain at no point in the past. And you could see on my poor, manipulated sister's face conflict as her little brain attempted to devote resources to feeling the pain and suffering surprise she just experienced or contemplating her newfound identity as a unicorn. And the latter won out. Instead of crying, instead of ceasing our play, instead of waking my parents with all the negative consequences that would have ensued for me, instead, a smile spread across her face, and she scrambled right back up onto the bunk bed with all the grace of a baby unicorn with one broken leg. Well, we stumbled across, at this tender age of just 5 and 7, we had no idea at the time, was something that was going to be at the vanguard of a scientific revolution occurring 2 decades later in the way that we look at the human brain. What we had stumbled across is something called positive psychology, which is the reason that I'm here today and the reason that I wake up every morning. When I first started talking about this research outside of academia, out with companies and schools, the very first thing they said to never do is to start your talk with a graph. The very first thing I wanted to do is start my talk with a graph. This graph looks boring, but this graph is the reason that I get excited and wake up every morning. And this graph doesn't even mean anything. It's fake data. What we found is if I got this data back studying you here in the room, I would be thrilled because there's very clearly a trend that's going on there, and that means that I can get published, which is all that really matters. The fact that there's one weird red dot that's up above the curve, there's one weird in the room, you know who you are. I saw you earlier. That's no problem. That's no problem, as most of you know, because I can just delete that dot. I can delete that dot because that's clearly a measurement error, and we know that's a measurement error because it's messing up my data. So one of the very first things that we teach people in economics and statistics and business and psychology courses is how, in a statistically valid way, do we eliminate the weirdos? How do we eliminate the outliers so that we can find the line of best fit, which is fantastic if I'm trying to find out how many Advil the average person should be taking, too. But if I'm interested in potential, if I'm interested in your potential or for happiness or productivity or energy or creativity, what we're doing is we're creating the cult of the average with science. If I ask a question like, how fast can a child learn how to read in a classroom? Scientists change the answer to, how fast does the average child learn how to read in that classroom? And then we tailor the class right towards the average. Now, if you fall below the average on this curve, then psychologists get thrilled, because that means you're either depressed or you have a disorder or hopefully both. We're hoping for both because our business model is if you come into a therapy session with one problem, we want to make sure you leave knowing you have 10. So you'll keep coming back over and over again. We'll go back into your childhood if necessary, but eventually what we want to do is to make you normal again. But normal is merely average. And what I posit and what positive psychology posits is that if we study what is merely average, we will remain merely average. That instead of deleting those positive outliers, what I intentionally do is come into a population like this one and says, why? Why is it that some of you are so high above the curve in terms of your intellectual ability, athletic ability, musical ability, creativity, energy levels, your resiliency in the face of challenge, your sense of humor? Whatever it is, instead of deleting you, what I want to do is study you. Because maybe we can glean information, not just how to move people up to the average, but how we can move the entire average up at our companies and schools worldwide. The reason this graph is important to me is when I turn on the news, it seems like the majority of the information is not positive. In fact, it's negative. Most of it's about murder, corruption, diseases, natural disasters, and very quickly, my brain starts to think that's the accurate ratio of negative to positive in the world. What that's doing is creating something called the medical school syndrome, which if you know people who have been to medical school during the first year of medical training, as you read through a list of all the symptoms and diseases that could happen, suddenly you realize you have all of them. I have a brother-in-law named Bobo, which is a whole other story. Bobo married Amy the unicorn. Bobo called me on the phone from Yale Medical School. From Yale Medical School, and Bobo said, Sean, I have leprosy. which even at Yale is extraordinarily rare. But I had no idea how to console poor Bobo because he had just gotten over an entire week of menopause. See, what we're finding is it's not necessarily the reality that shapes us, but the lens through which your brain views the world that shapes your reality. And if we can change the lens, not only can we change your happiness, we can change every single educational and business outcome at the same time. When I applied to Harvard, I applied on a dare. I didn't expect to get in, and my family had no money for college. When I got a military scholarship 2 weeks later, they allowed me to go. Suddenly, something that wasn't even a possibility became a reality. When I went there, I assumed everyone else would see it as a privilege as well, that they'd be excited to be there. Even if you're in a classroom full of people smarter than you, you'd be happy just to be in that classroom, which is what I felt. But what I found there is while some people experienced that, when I graduated after my 4 years and then spent the next 8 years living in the dorms with the students, Harvard asked me to. I wasn't that guy. But what happened... I was an officer of Harvard to counsel students through the difficult 4 years, and what I found in my research, my teaching, is that these students, no matter how happy they were with the original success of getting into the school, 2 weeks later, their brains were focused not on the privilege of being there, nor on their philosophy or their physics. Their brain was focused on the competition, the workload, the hassles, the stresses, the complaints. When I first went in there, I walked into the freshman dining hall, which is where my friends from Waco, Texas, which is where I grew up, I know some of you have heard of it. When they come to visit me, they look around, they say, this freshman dining hall looks like something out of Hogwarts from the movie Harry Potter, which it does. This is Hogwarts from the movie Harry Potter, and that's Harvard. And when they see this, they say, Sean, why do you waste your time studying happiness at Harvard? Seriously, what does a Harvard student possibly have to be unhappy about? Embedded within that question is the key to understanding the science of happiness. Because what that question assumes is that our external world is predictive of our happiness levels. When in reality, if I know everything about your external world, I can only predict 10% of your long-term happiness. 90% of your long-term happiness is predicted not by the external world, but by the way your brain processes the world. And if we change it, if we change our formula for happiness and success, what we can do is change the way that we can then affect reality. What we found is that only 25% of job successes are predicted by IQ. 75% of job successes are predicted by your optimism levels, your social support, and your ability to see stress as a challenge instead of as a threat. I talked to a boarding school up in New England, probably the most prestigious boarding school, and they said, we already know that. So every year, instead of just teaching our students, we also have a wellness week, and we're so excited. Monday night, we have the world's leading expert coming in to speak about adolescent depression. Tuesday night is school violence and bullying. Wednesday night is eating disorders. Thursday night is illicit drug use. And Friday night, we're trying to decide between risky sex or happiness. I said, that's most people's Friday nights. Which I'm glad you liked, but they did not like that at all. Silence on the phone. And into the silence, I said, I'd be happy to speak at your school, but just so you know, that's not a wellness week. That's a sickness week. What you've done is you've outlined all the negative things that can happen, but not talked about the positive. The absence of disease is not health. Here's how we get to health. We need to reverse the formula for happiness and success. In the past 3 years, I've traveled to 45 different countries, working with schools and companies in the midst of an economic downturn. And what I found is that most companies and schools follow a formula for success, which is this. If I work harder, I'll be more successful. And if I'm more successful, then I'll be happier. That undergirds most of our parenting styles, our managing styles, the way that we motivate our behavior, and the problem is it's scientifically broken and backwards for two reasons. First, every time your brain has a success, you just change the goalpost of what success looked like. You got good grades, now you have to get better grades. You got into a good school, now you have to get a better school. You got a good job, now you have to get a better job. You hit your sales target, we're gonna change your sales target. And if happiness is on the opposite side of success, your brain never gets there. What we've done is we've pushed happiness over the cognitive horizon as a society. And that's because we think we have to be successful, then we'll be happier. But the real problem is our brains work in the opposite order. If you can raise somebody's level of positivity in the present, then their brain experiences what we now call a happiness advantage, which is your brain at positive performs significantly better than it does at negative, neutral, or stressed. Your intelligence rises, your creativity rises, your energy levels rise. In fact, what we found is that every single business outcome improves. Your brain at positive is 31% more productive than your brain at negative, neutral, or stressed. You're 37% better at sales. Doctors are 19% faster, more accurate at coming up with the correct diagnosis when positive instead of negative, neutral, or stressed, which means we can reverse the formula. If we can find a way of becoming positive in the present, then our brains work even more successfully as we're able to work harder, faster, and more intelligently. What we need to be able to do is to reverse this formula so we can start to see what our brains are actually capable of. Because dopamine, which floods into your system when you're positive, has two functions. Not only does it make you happier, it turns on all the learning centers in your brain, allowing you to adapt to the world in a different way. We found that there are ways you can train your brain to be able to become more positive. In just a 2-minute span of time, done for 21 days in a row, we can actually rewire your brain, allowing your brain to actually work more optimistically and more successfully. We've done these things in research now in every single company that I've worked with, getting them to write down 3 new things that they're grateful for 21 days in a row, 3 new things each day. And at the end of that, their brain starts to retain a pattern of scanning the world not for the negative, but for the positive first. Journaling about one positive experience you've had over the past 24 hours allows your brain to relive it. Exercise teaches your brain that your behavior matters. We find that meditation allows your brain to get over the cultural ADHD that we've been creating by trying to do multiple tasks at once, and allows our brains to focus on the task at hand. And finally, random acts of kindness or conscious acts of kindness. We get people when they open up their inbox to write one positive email praising or thanking somebody in their social support network. And by doing these activities and by training your brain just like we train our bodies, what we found is we could reverse the formula for happiness and success, and in doing so, not only create ripples of positivity, but create a real revolution. Thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to end the show with a little Ricky Gervais and his new discovered belief in the Bible. Really? It's a funny bit. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
She's pretty big. I used to think we evolved from apes. Darwin's theory of evolution through natural selection seemed pretty watertight. But in doing research for this show, I came across a theory that deviates from Darwin's, and I believe that. I just found it in a dusty old book in a library. It's called The Bible. And Darwin was wrong. We didn't evolve. God made us. So I just want to explain to you exactly how that happened. Okay. The first book of Moses, commonly called Genesis. Start at the beginning. Fairly big book, but... Friday, innit? Lock the doors? Okay. Took me 4 years to get this platform. Now they listen. Just think if I'd have blown it, just going door to door. Right, okay. Some of the things you're hear do sound a little bit far-fetched. I admit that. I thought it was a bit. But then I found out that the other name for the Bible is the Gospel. So it is all true. So, luckily, clue is in the title. Okay. Come on. It's the Bible. Okay. Chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. It doesn't go into detail. He doesn't need to explain to you. You probably understand it because he's got a massive brain. Yours is little. And you go, what? He goes, don't. What? Just trust me. I did. And also, if he explained it to you, it would like ruin the enigma. Do you know what I mean? You'd go, that's amazing. He'd just say, it's a trick. And you go, oh. So it's like seeing, no, it's like David Blaine did something. And you go, oh, that is real magic. And you go, no, I'm just standing on one leg and lifting the other up. Easy. So, keeps his cards very close to his chest. God, good luck to him. He can do what he wants. He can do anything, so he can do what he wants. Okay, here we go. In the beginning, God created the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. Bit dark, he sorted that out. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. Huh? Isn't that brilliant? Hey? Oh, come on, that's amazing. He made light up. It was dark, it was nothing before. It's not like he saw some on holiday and went, that'll be good back on earth. He made it up. Do you not, there was nothing to go by. It wasn't like there was twilight and he went, let's have that a little bit brighter. He just went, let there be light. And at the speed of light, he didn't go, let there be light. Come on, I'm busy. It's the first day. I've got a lot to do. I've only got 7 days. Do you know what I mean? And he probably didn't have to say it. He did say it, but he could have gone, that's exactly what I was thinking of. Brilliant. Do you know what I mean? Come on, he's amazing. What are you? Free your minds. Listen, right, okay. So he did the light, invented it. Which means that he created the heaven and the earth in the dark. Fucking hell. How good is that? I'd have gone, right, let's have a little bit of light and let's see what we're doing. Right. I need some planets. He went, that's everything, let's have a look. Brilliant. And God saw the light and saw that it was good. Even though he says so himself. it is good, but just, if there's pride in your work, then there's arrogance. We'd all like to write our own reviews. Okay. And lo, Gervais was not only a handsome man, but a funny fucker. Maybe I'll do me own. Who knows? Okay. Anyway, called the light day, called the darkness night. That's chapter one, did all those things. Chapter two, he did swarmy things that swarmeth, creepy things that creepeth, all that. All the beasts of the field, made man. Different method there. He could have said, let there be man. There would have been man, definitely. But he made him out of some dust just because he can. We don't think we'll do that. Ooh, right, done. It's a man. What, do you want a woman? Yeah, you can make out of some dust. No, one of your ribs. Just, you can't do that. All right? So, brilliant. And we made them, put them in the Garden of Eden with all the animals, and they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. Okay, brilliant. He's done well there. Now, chapter three, and I'm not having a go at him, because he is brilliant, but in my humble opinion, I think the snake was a mistake. Okay, chapter three. His difficult third series. It's going to get criticised, whatever, isn't it? After all the good he did in one and two. He should just leave it there. Chapter 3. Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said unto the woman, it's a talking snake, did I not? Yeah. Oh, yeah. What, you don't believe you can make a talking snake? You having a laugh? Of course you can, do anything. And perfect diction as well. Not a mumbling snake. Why, he didn't make all that snake to, oh, fucking hell, I've got a cleft palate. Why did I do that? Perfect. Again, that's how I wanted it. Right. Oh, and it speaks English. Which is lucky for me, because I'd be fucked. I don't speak another language. No, I did O-level French, but you don't need to speak French if you're English. You don't need to. Don't, you know what I mean? You don't. If you go to France, point, talk a little bit louder. If he still doesn't understand what you're saying, smash the place up. Secure in the knowledge that you tried your best. Don't get me started on the French. Don't get me started. They know about animals. They fucking eat most of them. God. God. I can have a go at the French, because I'm half French, half English with a stupid name like Gervais. No, I am. I'm half French, half English. And I've got qualities of both, French and English, which is good. So I am crap in bed, but at least I've got bad breath. Not as bad as the Swiss. I don't get started. Oh, we're neutral. We don't want to fight on either side. Not really a loss not having Switzerland on your side in a war, is it really? With their army. Have you seen the little knives they carry? What? Oh. All right, back off. He's got some tweezers. And he said unto the woman, yea, hath God said, ye shall not eat of every tree of the garden? And the woman said unto the serpent, she's talking back, she knows no better. And the woman said unto the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God hath said, ye shall not eat of it, neither shall ye touch it, lest ye die. And the serpent said unto the woman, getting quite chatty now. And the serpent said unto the woman, ye shall not surely die. For God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. He's saying, well, okay, that's not strictly true. He's pulling the wool over your eyes a little bit there, because he doesn't want you to have this sort of knowledge. He doesn't want you to lose your innocence, so you won't die. She believes the snake. She eats the apple. She gives it to Adam. And the snake's right. They don't die, but their eyes are opened, and they're embarrassed by their nakedness, and they cover themselves up. God comes along. He sees this. He's furious. Ooh. He goes, what are you wearing clothes for in the Garden of Eden? They go, embarrassed and that. He goes, what? Take them off. No. What? I was looking at them. I made them big so I could see them from heaven. No, you... Who told you about the apple? She goes, the snake stitched it right up. So God goes mental. He's firm but fair. Well, you don't. If he loses his rag, he can do anything. So he starts handing out punishments. The punishment he gives to the man is that he'll have to toil the field from now on. He won't get manna from heaven. Punishment he gives to Eve, womankind, is that she'll have terrible pain in childbirth. The punishment he gives to the snake, who fucked up everything, remember? The punishment he gave to the snake was, you shall crawl on your belly all your days. Not really a punishment for a snake. I bet it couldn't believe its luck. Stand there going, I'm in fucking trouble. And you have to crawl on your belly. But I already, oh no. Oh, yeah, you've done me, No, we're even now, yeah, that's, I asked for that, okay, cheers, see you later. Oh, how does this work again? Oh, ow, oh, I'm being punished. Oh, this is rubbish, I wish I could fly like normal. I don't know why he put the snake there, particularly one that talks and blabs, do you know what I mean? Or don't have the tree there, one or the other. It's an accident waiting to happen, isn't it? Where was he, by the way, when this was happening? Well, he's meant to be everywhere. When the snake came up to Eve and went, so why didn't he go, fuck off, shut up, don't listen to that. Fuck off. Just over it. Bollocks, 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 bollocks. Just keep an eye on it. Or make it all. And then go to Eve, right, Eve, come here, right, that apple, right, I wouldn't lie, I'm God, right, it will kill you. Oh, by the way, if a snake comes and talks to you, he's a lying little shit. But I used to believe in all that.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch,